Welcome to Business Watch. November marks the 134th anniversary of the Johannesburg Securities Exchange, and it all harks back to the discovery of gold in the Wits Basin back in 1886, which resulted in the formation of the great mining finance houses, with investors really needing a central facility to access primary capital. Initially, trading took place in a miner's tent and moved to the stables at the corner of what is now Sauer and Commissioner Streets. Benjamin Miners Wallen proposed to a meeting of the Exchange and Chambers Company board and members that the Johannesburg Stock Exchange should be established, and on the 8th of November 1887, Wallen founded the JSE by providing a facility to conduct all of the trading. Now, following the first legislation covering financial markets in 1947, shortly after the Second World War, the JSE joined the World Federation of Exchanges in 1963, and then upgraded to an electronic trading system in the early 90s. We then saw the bourse demutualizing and listing on its own exchange in 2005. Back in 2003, we saw the JSE launching the Altex, which is for small and mid-sized listings, followed by Yieldex for interest rate and currency instruments. And currently we have the JSE acquiring the South African Futures Exchange of SAFEX, also in the early 2000s, and the Bond Exchange of South Africa. And we've got five financial markets, namely equities and bonds, as well as financial, commodity, and interest rate derivatives. And it's an interesting time because we now have more competition. We've also got a stagnant local economy and a wave of delistings, but encouragingly a mining boom again, which is really all about the beginnings of the JSE. To reflect on the history of the JSE and this grand old dame in South African markets, it's a real pleasure to welcome Dr. Leila Faree, who is the Group CEO of the JSE, Sasfin Securities Deputy Chairman David Shapiro, and Lister Mainchies, who is now an independent but has had a storied career in investment management all throughout the years. Leila, welcome. Let's reflect a little before we talk about the exchange of today. Looking back at the history of the JSE, what really stands out for you?
Well, Michael, as you so rightly said, we were really born on the bedrock of the gold discovery in 1886, and in 1887 the JSC was formed. Interestingly, a competitor exchange sprung up called the Rival Union Exchange, and that traded from 1933 to 1958. And it's really interesting to look through the history of the JSC. We're busy creating a coffee table book, and to see how we've been through the First World War, during which time the JSE actually closed its exchange for a number of days. We've also experienced some really global stock market crashes. For example, the 1987 October 19 stock exchange, which David will no doubt remember, and that became known as Black Monday. And the crash began in Hong Kong and then spread worldwide. We've also sort of seen through the new constitution of South Africa, and our electronic trading system was introduced in June of 1997, and that marked a profound switch from those big personalities on the trading floor to the geeky quants who were then sitting behind trading systems. So we've seen a fascinating evolution over the years.
And it really is funny, David, when I can hear you laughing, to listen to Leila describe it. The big personalities announce the geeky quants. You've seen it all. I'm not saying you were right there at the very beginning, but close enough. What stands out for you in the era of the old trading floor and you know, bow ties and looking at big chalkboards to where we are now?
Well, I joined in 1972, 1st of February, as I came out of my articles, counting articles. The next day I joined this JSE, which is 1st of February 1972, so it'll be my 50th year in a couple of months' time. But so much has changed. And, you know, if I could talk about the political, the economic, and the technical side, but just I love telling the the technical stories, because Leila has said we moved to geeks. And I think, Leila, I have to correct you, I think it was in June 1996 that we actually made that the first transition to electronics, because I remember that day very, very well. But when I started on the stock exchange, we used to communicate by telex and telegram. There was no direct dialing. So if you wanted to talk to your counterparts in London, you either sent a telegram, a coded telegram, alternatively used a telex machine, or you booked a call with the exchange, you know, and you'd wait for calls to come. So we only got direct dialing in 1978, and that changed the whole complexity. So when we went electronic in 1996, it was a complete shift of starting with telegrams to being able to access, you know, access trading directly and that. So there's been massive technological changes which have changed, and all for the better. You know, yeah. I love the floor. I don't want to hog. I love the trading floor. But today we're about 100 times more efficient than we were in those good old days where you had these hefty personalities.
And it is, because markets are all about information, isn't it? And in the days when you had to wait to receive a telegram or a telex, you know, it was about having that information by going to an AGM, understanding the companies. Now, it's almost as if you can move markets by tweeting information, and we see you know, the rise of short sellers. And I suppose that creates different headaches, different challenges for markets and market regulators as well. But I don't want to dive ahead into that just yet. Listen, all the way from New Zealand, which I believe is still in lockdown. What stands out for you over the last 50 odd years of the JSE that you can remember?
No, well, I think, I started in the boom of 68, 69, which is just before David. I was only a student at the time. And so I recognize that sort of froth in markets. And I kind of know what is likely to follow. And again, we've had other brushes of blood to the head. And I can remember one JSE president at one stage, we were concerned as asset managers of the quality of the items that were getting listed on the stock exchange. And we took it upon ourselves to say, you know, surely you have a duty. And the answer came back, we are here to make a market, not to judge the quality of the tomatoes. So I've never forgotten the story of the tomatoes.
Well, there are quite a few rotten tomatoes that have been squashed in the last few years, if one thinks of Steinhoff and Tongaat and a few others. But, you know, there's a difficult balancing act, and perhaps we should just dive straight into that area of the market, Leila. On the one hand, there are complaints, very vocal complaints, that listing is onerous, it's difficult, it's costly, it's expensive, all of those things. On the other hand, investors are asking for protection. They want fewer rotten tomatoes, for example. How do you approach that balance, striking that balance between too much regulation on the one hand and not enough on the other?
Michael, it's an age-old cyclical problem that we tend to deal with. In the downturn, when stock valuations are at their lowest and trading is difficult and economics are difficult, you tend to have many, many complaints about the red tape and about what's happening. You need to see things in context, however. So if we think about SA GDP, over the last, in 2018, it grew by 1.5%, and last year it was down by 6.4%. And in contrast, our market cap for the equity market has grown at around 15% CAGR since the beginning of 2019. In fact, we hit 70,000, which is the highest mark in the history of the JSE. So if you take a long run view over 2020, over the last 10 years since 2010, we've grown by 120%, or we are now 35 times bigger in market cap. So although the number of stocks have shrunk, and many people are blaming red tape for that, it's a much bigger and much more complex dynamic than that. And unfortunately, what we really need to do is to create a growth node for our small and mid-cap companies. Those are the companies that are delisting, and that is the growth node of the future. And we think that there's not enough liquidity and not enough investor interest in those small cap markets. We are doing a lot. We're looking at potentially chatting to regulators about tax treatment treatment. David created StockPicks, and we've morphed that into a small and mid-cap approach. We've got contracting research, and so we're looking at how we can stimulate and increase research in that space. But it's not a simple problem, and it's not solved with one element, for example, cutting red tape. We have gone through a red tape exercise and last year, and we are busy in the process of investigating and implementing some reductions in the amount of red tape.
Yeah, it's clearly a very complex issue, David, and you've seen different market cycles, and a lot of those points that Leila raises are extremely valid. How do we ensure that we grow, generally, the size of our capital markets and just make investing sexy again, not just for the institutions, but the retail investors here?
Do you want a controversial answer? Just get rid of the ETFs and get rid of the unit trust. Those tracker funds are killing us. You know, everybody wants to hug the index and play safe. And you don't build wealth by playing safe. You build wealth by doing your own research and looking at businesses. And Leila will tell you, you know, I've tried to help in promoting smaller businesses. And when you see the gains that you have made on businesses that have been around, you know, for a long time, and are solid businesses, when you see the gains relative to the index, I mean, they outstrip them by a huge percentage. I was just looking at Barlow World's results this morning. Great numbers there. Company been around forever. The shares up 50% versus the index up around about, 17, 18%. And that's the kind of money you can make if you're prepared to do a little bit of research and stop hugging the index. So you're talking to a veteran here who loves to go and delve into individual shares rather than just try and find some ETF that it's been sold to you by a product salesman. So that's my pitch for the JSE.
And I think it's a fantastic pitch, and one that we in the media love to talk about as well, because we love profiling the small and mid-cap companies, and that is, David, where we've seen the growth over the last 12 months in particular. And often we see the big buyouts, international private equity funds coming out seeing the value that many of our local investors are not seeing right in front of their very eyes. But what would you say, Liston, before I jump to you, is the reason behind that?
They go in, they're looking for something to buy. Look at the Distell. Look what happened there. Great company gone. I mean, a company with a great legacy. It's been around for a long time. Even if we go deep down into Remgro, you'll find some wonderful companies listed within Remgro, you know, that could be released. So I like to push for, more of these businesses that are just hiding there and being, held in private equity businesses or held in those kind of conglomerates to be released into the market that we can participate. So I think it's a push. We can't put it on Leila. You know, it's not fair for her to do it. But certainly commentators like ourselves or analysts like ourselves can keep pushing it and keep pushing the story.
Yeah, and listen, to bring you in, it is a global trend. This is not to say it's the JSE per se, but globally we have seen a decline in the number of publicly traded companies. Companies have tended to want to go and raise capital privately. Is it just because it's easier, because of the rise of private equity and private debt funds and the like, that you don't need big public capital markets anymore?
Well, I think on the international front, we are seeing lots and lots of activity. And of course, there's a lot of hype around an awful lot of them. And in fact, going back to my 1969 story, and maybe even the 1998 story, you know, people are buying things they haven't a clue what they actually do. They're called a spec, and they have some name behind it. And that's all you need to know, and it'll be on a price to sales ratio of 100, never mind price earnings multiples. Earnings, well, we don't worry about those. So what I'm saying is there's definitely different thinking operating in international markets to our local. But again, a lot of it comes back, I would say, to the fact that we were in a cocoon for an awfully long time, if you remember the financial rand, and it caused all kinds of complexities for foreigners coming in, but made it difficult for us as locals as well. And with that demise, we are part of the world. And as it turns out, our GDP is very small in world terms, and our industries are incredibly small in relation to anything that you can see on most other exchanges. So for an American to feel that he would want to come and buy, even Barlow World, by the way, he can buy the big winner in Barlow World called Caterpillar. He can buy that in the United States. Why would he buy yellow metal in South Africa?
And Leila, to come back to you, that you know, delistings is a global issue. How do we make South Africa attractive again? And I know it's not all up to the JSE. If you think of small miners, junior miners, exploration companies, we need to have the right regulatory framework, and that comes from the DMRE, and we're not seeing that happen. So that's strangling the golden goose here. How do you see the JSE playing a more active role in trying to stimulate listings in the country?
Michael, it is very much a global trend. There are only three exchanges that have been in positive territory in terms of number of listings, and we're amongst the NYSE, who are down by 15%, LSE, who have been down by 21% over the last 10 years, Singapore down by 11%, and the JSE's down by 17%. So lots of money going into private capital, and fully agree with Liston's perspective, which is there is a policy uncertainty dynamic. We've seen enormous disinvestment out of the country. So there is a lot that we need to do. Firstly, to start to attract capital back into the country. South Africa has also been downweighted in the emerging market indices. We've been crowded out by the likes of the upweighting of China and also the Saudi Arabia introduction. And so we need to do more about putting our perspective forward in the global markets so that we can attract investment. There are a number of attractive single name stocks which are attracting investment, and so there is a possibility that we see more situations like the Distell takeout. Now, as sad as it is to see large legacy companies leaving the exchange, it's also the exchange's role to create prosperity and to unlock shareholder value. And so takeouts like that really do signal that we've had successful companies. South Africa also has a number of large dual-listed companies, and we need to continue to drive that trend. We have a lot of a number of rand hedges, and we're seeing the Coca-Cola bottling company, for example, signaling. We're seeing mobile phones looking at unbundling their companies. So we also need to build a stronger pathway to Southeast Asia. The exchange is putting a lot in place to do that. We're also building out an SME ecosystem, which will create more of a pipeline for listings. So we've recently announced that we are applying for a license to provide private markets in both the infrastructure and SME space. And we hope that that will stimulate and encourage and crowd in a bit more investment. I think ultimately there is a huge focus on government, on electricity provision, which has a compounding effect, on managing corruption, and on growing those real growth nodes like infrastructure and SME markets. And so we all need to stack hands, and we need to collaborate and work together to build business confidence and to rebuild those inbound flows.
Because it's a pipeline, you know, as you say, that's what the capital markets are there for. You want to see the young companies grow, thrive, flourish, and then people exit eventually and seeing a significant return. David, let's bring it back to what's happening in South Africa today and that environment. I mean, you recently spent a week in the Kruger and tweeted that it's good to see the tourists are coming back. You better book soon. But the power issue, it seems to be a case of two steps forward, one back, and there's no accountability. We still haven't seen any accountability for July. What do you make of this current administration?
Well, don't get me into the politics, because I think, Leila has said it very eloquently. You know, until we get the politics right and we get our economic policy or our industrial policy right, we're not going to attract what we can. And believe me, we can attract if we get it right. We've still got an array of minerals here that is the envy of the world. You know, there's still enormous amount of potential in that area. And of course, every time you build a mine, you build an ecosystem around it. You know, when a mine closes, everything around it closes as well, all the little businesses as well. And Liston will pay tribute to this as well, or understand that. You know, the gold mines, when I came on in 1972, there were 40 different miners. And in those days, we used to deal the mine. We didn't deal the gold price, because the success of the mine depended on its production, the grade that it mined at, and generally the efficiencies of that individual mine. And it was, you know, we didn't say the gold price is going up, because it was a set gold price. And we can still do that. You know, you can still do that in the platinum miners today. So it's very, very important that we get that policy right. But the one thing I must say about South Africa is that the quality of the companies that are on the stock exchange are world-class. Our retailers, our banks are really world-class businesses, because they operate under conditions that no other company operates under. They can handle anything. And I mean, when you see the results that they produce, I'm always astounded by how successful our companies are and how well run they actually are.
Anything except going into Nigeria and doing a deal, we won't go there.
That's the investment bankers, you see. Those are the curse of the world. They come with their briefcases and their laptops, and they go sit at the boardroom table, and they convince these poor chaps to go into areas that they shouldn't go into. Just be careful of those pimply kids, that's all I'm saying.
Listen, what's your view on South Africa, from the outside almost looking in, because you've been in New Zealand for some time now, and just to give us that broader international perspective of the way South Africa is being viewed, and particularly, you know, the let's face it, the Ramaphosa administration was given a lot of breathing room in the beginning, and people are now growing a little bit weary and impatient.
Well, again, just understand, the international investor has a wide array to pick from. And when the headlines do not read well, whether it's power crisis, or whether it's a trial of the former president, whether it is the rioting and looting that you saw earlier this year, they just say, I don't need to be there. And it's as very simple as that. And it goes back to what we've even said earlier. You know, it's not even so much a case of policy. Mm. It's an understanding that we need foreign investment. And when we say foreign investors are more important than, you won't find any party in South Africa actually making that statement. So I think somewhere along the line, we need to have a much more holistic view of how we can put things right. And again, going back to David's point, and I said this about 5 years ago, I said, show me a new mine. Show me the plans for a new mine. And you can go to some of the mining indabas, and people have said, we'll go anywhere except South Africa. And the minister was there. It isn't as though he didn't hear that.
Yeah.
So until we hear words coming from officialdom that says, we are a mining country, we want to develop mines, we will participate in the booms that are in front of us. But I haven't heard those words. So until I get a change of tone, a change of voice, I think there must be plenty other places for money to go.
So sad, but no sense of exaggeration there, that the DMRE, if you look either at the energy side or the mining side, remains one of the major constraints still to economic growth. And Minister Gwede Mantashe, sadly, has a lot to account for. I want to shift on, Leila, to where capital markets are going. And I had the CEO of Renergen on the show, Stefano Morano, recently talking about, it's basically an old school mining streaming transaction, but they've made it sexy. They digitized the assets and created tokens, and they forward sold them. Is this the future of capital markets?
It certainly will be an enabler. We are investigating a number of solutions. As you may be aware, we invested a stake in a global fintech company in the UK called Globacap, and they provide digitized assets. And They power private markets. So digitized registries, private markets is certainly the way things are going. I think you're going to see an uneven adaptation and evolution of this process, and it may be regionalized. And the big question will be, how will publicly issued crypto or digital currencies play out against privately issued crypto or digitized assets? We have investigated a number of use cases looking at, for example, digitized or tokenized commodity markets. And we've actually spent some time with Stefano Morani of Renogen looking at that concept. And we are actually planning a trip early next year with our regulators to visit the Swiss Stock Exchange, who have in fact created a separate digital market. So this space is still very much embryonic and evolving in the regulatory space, and it's very difficult to predict where regulations will land and how enabling those will be. But ultimately, any market that evolves, as we've seen from moving from the gold standard to the fiat money standard, we need to start to embrace and enable that and to create an appropriate regulatory and risk management ecosystem around it, rather than to leave it in the shadow as a shadow financial market.
That's where we're going to have to end it off, as we've enjoyed remembering 134 years of South Africa's capital markets alongside David Shapiro of Sasfin Securities, the deputy chairman, and Liston Mainchies, now an independent, coming to us from New Zealand, quite late over there in New Zealand at the moment. You've been watching Business Watch here on Business Day TV.